Hello, my name is John Calladine, and welcome to this second podcast on key problem accounting and other issues facing charities today. Firstly, going concern. We live in uncertain times, in days of very difficult economic circumstances, and in the charity world, major uncertainty as to whether existing funding will be maintained, and therefore are projects with which charities involved sustainable in the not only long term, but short term also. The amount of money which was available to the charitable sector through government and local authority funding over recent years was vast, and sustainability has never really become a major issue until now. However, the word going concern now has to be applied to a charity, particularly those who are dependent upon ongoing support in the form of grants and contractual services. It is not unknown, of course, for charities to live very close to the wire, and that many charities spend the money they receive and are reluctant to hoard large reserves. The general fund balance of a charity is, of course, a key indicator. If the general fund is overdrawn, then the charity is insolvent. It may have large surpluses of restricted funds, but these are tied to specific projects, to the wishes of the donor, and cannot necessarily be applied to the general fund. The general fund dealing with, of course, the core costs and core operations of the charity. Most certainly, if you are dealing with the financial statements of a charity and you have a very low general fund balance, then you have to address the issue of going concern. In March 2009, the FRC, that is Financial Reporting Council, issued an update for directors of smaller companies regarding going concern, and this is just as relevant for charities as to other commercial entities. This update was not only addressed to directors and trustees of charitable companies, but also to any other entity which uses the FRISI, that is, Financial Reporting Standard for Smaller Entities, which would virtually include all charities following the SORP, that is, the Statement of Recommended Practice, where the income is within the independent examination bands. It speaks of companies following the language of the FRISI, as the FRISI makes clear this language is just used for convenience and is not meant to exclude accounts of entities such as charities with other legal structures. Going concern, therefore, is an issue which trustees, accountants, etc. need to address. Independent examiners need to address this under Direction 8 of the guidelines issued by the Charity Commission for Independent Examinations. And of course, to a statutory auditor, it is a basic requirement. Fixed assets is my next subject. Although rare now, I have come across over the years many instances where fixed assets are being depreciated via a charge to the general fund of a charity, but really the money was originally given through a restricted fund. It is therefore important when acquiring assets given through restricted grants or gifts or contractual arrangements that those fixed assets are identified as restricted and the corresponding depreciation charge put to the restricted fund. In simple terms, money is received, debit the bank, and credit the grant to the SOFA. The purchase of the asset is made, credit bank, debit fixed assets. The asset is then depreciated and written off over the term of its life, debit the SOFA and the particular fund to which the money relates, credit the balance sheet. If a charity specifically wants to debit the full expenditure of the asset against the corresponding income within the restricted fund, then there is no reason why this should not be done. However, then a separate account is set up within the accounting records, and say call it fixed asset fund, and credit that fund with the original grant, and then debit the depreciation charge over the term of the asset. Trustees. Many charities now find difficulty in recruiting trustees. Trustees being those who have the legal and fiscal responsibility and governance of the charity, irrespective of whether they delegate this to a chief executive or other support staff. Trustees are similar, of course, to a board of directors, have the ultimate responsibility in law. It is best practice that trustees are given training and assistance in understanding their responsibilities. Trustees' indemnity insurance is available to allay any fears that a trustee may have in acting. However, what is important is that all transactions with trustees are disclosed within the financial statements of the charity. It is now not uncommon for certain trustees to be paid salaries. Very often, it is important that the chief executive is also a trustee, and details of the remuneration package would need to be disclosed in the financial statements. In the area of religious charities, where ministers of religion, pastors, or whatever term is applied, they are an integral part of the running of the church/charity. So much decision-making is in their hands, they are in effect a trustee, whether they want to be called that or not. Disclosure of payments to them would therefore be necessary within the accounts of the charity/church. It is quite common practice now for the articles of association or trustee of a charity to be written in such a way that trustees can be paid for their services, whether contractual or via unemployment. It is considered best practice that there is always a minority of paid trustees, and therefore they should always absent themselves from meetings or declare their interest when discussing salaries or their remuneration package. This brings me to related party transactions, and again, disclosure being necessary in the financial statements of the charity. Related parties can be other family members of trustees, or those who have an influence on the affairs of the charity, business partners, etc. Where transactions are carried out with such persons, these have to be disclosed, and systems need to be implemented to ensure that full records are kept and transactions can be and or are disclosed in the minutes of the charity and accounts. It is not uncommon to find spouses being employed by charity trustees for the work of a charity, and such expressions as equal opportunities need to be considered when employing such people. Branch accounting. It is not unknown for many national charities to have branches in local towns or districts. Many charities would actually give independence to the local branches and allow them to become charities within their own right, with full accountability and reporting requirements. However, some have not taken this route and adopt a branch accounting system, where the financial records have to be integrated into the full annual financial statements of the charity. Therefore, systems need to be put in place so that information is available for the annual accounts, and indeed suitable internal controls apparent from an auditing or independent examination perspective. In these cases, usually the head office issue strict guidelines and form filling, which needs to be done each month by the local branch. Sometimes the local branch will have its own bank account. Public benefit. Following the Charities Act 2006, it is now a requirement for charities to disclose in their annual report as to how the charity provides public benefit. There are two main principles to consider. One, there must be an identifiable benefit or benefits, and therefore clear what the benefit is, how the benefits are related to the aims of the charity, and the benefits must be balanced against any detriment or harm arising. 2. Second principle being that benefits must be made to the public or a section of the public, and not a narrow section. Beneficiaries therefore must be appropriate to the aims, and where the benefit is to a section of the public, the opportunity must not be unreasonably restricted by geographical or other restrictions or the ability to pay if fees are charged. And in particular, people in poverty must not be excluded from the opportunity to benefit. Advice is always available from the Charity Commission, and now, of course, they are applying various checks to existing charities to ensure that public benefit is maintained. And in case of new charities, public benefit having to be proved. One of the more sensitive areas is, of course, fee charging, educational establishments, schools, colleges and universities, and independent schools especially. These organisations have enjoyed charitable status for many years, with the obvious benefit of no taxes payable, gift aid recoverable, and other concessions available. To remain as a charity, they have to prove they are of public benefit, and ways of establishing this are offering free or subsidised bursaries to students, allowing the general public or others, say state schools, to use their various educational facilities, cooperation with state schools, allowing the general public to use the playing fields and other recreational parts of the independent school. For small charities below the audit threshold, trustees are required to include a brief summary in their trustees' annual report of the main activities undertaken in order to carry out the charity's aims for the public benefit. Charity Commission guidance suggests the two main principles previously mentioned should be addressed. Trustees can, of course, provide fuller public benefit statements if they wish. Larger charities above the audit threshold are required to provide a fuller explanation in their annual report of the significant activities undertaken in order to carry out the charity's aims to the public benefit, as well as their aims and strategies. They are required to explain the charity's achievements, measured by reference to the charity's aims, and to the objectives set out by the trustees. It is up to the trustees to decide how much detail they want to provide. The Charity Commission is not prescriptive about the number of words or pages needed. The charity that said nothing would obviously be in breach of its public benefit reporting requirement. This brings me to my last subject, VAT. VAT is a subject which is very much to the fore of charity thinking at the present time, particularly with the increase in the standard rate of VAT to 20%. A 20% additional cost is by no means insignificant in current times, something the charity may wish to avoid. It is a misconception, and still held by many, that charities do not have to pay VAT. Unfortunately, this is just not the case. We have to look at the matter from two perspectives. One, specific exemptions, and two, registration, and then how business supplies and non-business supplies are related. There are specific exemptions available in terms of input tax suffered, which can be avoided. Certain purchases by a charity can be zero-rated. These are primarily 1. Construction costs of a building to be used for relevant residential purposes and relevant charity non-business use, where it meets other conditions. This can include an addition to an existing building. 2. Additional and printing costs. The charity should provide the supplier with a certificate of declaration stating that the advertisement qualifies for zero rating. And this includes all adverts, including recruitment advertising. 3. Certain medical and scientific equipment and medicinal products can be zero rated. 4. Certain equipment designed to be used by handicapped people. 5. Talking books and wireless sets for blind people. However, as is apparent, these exemptions are very limited and do not cover general overheads where VAT is incurred. Turning now to VAT registration. This is the only way a charity can seek to recover substantial items of VAT input tax it suffers. However, a charity cannot just register, and many small charities are unable to register because their income is purely non-business income, that is, outside the scope of VAT. I am referring to donations, gifts, general grants, legacies, all of which are considered non-business. Therefore, as a charity is not producing standard rated or zero rated income, it cannot register. There is a VAT registration level of £69,000, but it is still, of course, possible to register voluntarily if the charity can demonstrate it has standard rated and zero rated income. Examples of standard rated income would be contractual services, counselling services, consultancy services, and VAT at 20% would be charged by the charity to the customer or recipient involved. Zero rated income would be the sale of products, not uncommon for many charities. Examples of zero rated income would be the sale of books, not uncommon for many charities, and the sale of donated goods. If the charity only had standard rated and zero rated income, then there would be no problem of full recovery of its input tax. But of course, it will not just have those supplies. It will also have its non-business income, donations, grants, legacies, etc., as I mentioned earlier in this podcast. In addition, of course, a charity would also have exempt income. Examples of exempt income would be educational facilities, very common with charities. In these cases, recovery of input tax is limited, and what is termed partial exemption applies. In very simple terms, it means you can only recover input tax on a pro rata basis to the levels of income you are receiving. There is what is termed the standard method of apportionment, where direct VAT input tax related to a standard rated or zero rated supply would be recoverable. VAT on other overhead items such as accountancy, printing, stationery, etc., which would be for the general purposes of the charity, would be apportioned. This, of course, all becomes very complex. The charity can apply for special schemes to meet its particular needs and individual circumstances, but obviously advice would be needed to be received in this very complex area. I hope this podcast has been of help to you in addressing some of the key problem areas of charity accounting. Thank you for listening.